Now, practicing is not always going to be fun, but when we are making music, if you're not feeling joy and having fun, then something is wrong. Something is wrong.
This episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Gurus Hang podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is Teresa May. Teresa, well, she's on a mission. From her early experiences in the Salvation Army Band to her current work with the group Mourning a Black Star, Teresa has always understood the power of music. After earning her master's degree in music performance from the Cincinnati University Conservatory of Music, Teresa has made it her mission to spread the gospel of music's ability to change the world and to be a bold voice for the underrepresented. So, pour yourself a big glass, flip a chair, and let the hang begin! All right, and we are back with another episode of the Trumpet Gurus Hang, and I am going back to my home state for this, back to OH. I am joined by Teresa May. Teresa, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Hi. I had to like get that in, but yes, great to meet you as well.
All right, well, awesome. You know, it's always great to meet a fellow Buckeye, you know, the Cleveland music scene. I mean, I haven't lived in Ohio for a number of years, and I was originally from Columbus, there's always, Cleveland has always been a music town.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's shaking up there? I mean, what's new and happening?
Yeah. I had this conversation kind of frequently with like colleagues and people in the area, and I'm convinced that there is something in the water up here. I think, you know, like we're really close to the lake. We're surrounded by a good amount of water. I feel like something has to be there, but it's a great like music filled city with a lot of different kind of niche and pockets of different types of music and art. So it's very cool and special up here, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously people know for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and stuff like that, but that there's some really interesting stuff that goes on, like not just in Cleveland, but then also in Northeastern Ohio, like, you know, you get over to Youngstown, which is not a great town, but hey, Sean Jones is from Youngstown. So, you know,
it's when, a fact.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess the question I wanted to ask you was, you know, as you know, you're teaching, you're playing, you're doing all that sort of stuff. What do you see as kind of being the driving force in that area?
I think that, I mean, and maybe it's just true for other cities. I've really only largely lived in Cleveland besides when I went away for school and I was still in Ohio. But Cleveland definitely in Ohio has this like grit to us, I think, that makes the art and our kind of work ethic just is what it is. I found for me that the scene here is really quite supportive. You know, you can go to a concert every day of the week and hear something different every night. We've got like a jazz scene, obviously. We've got the classical scene popping. We've got the experimental music. There's, you know, jam nights and art music and contemporary music and really anything that you might want to get into. I think there's a pocket and a scene for that here. I found that I'm able to get into whatever I might like at the time, you know, ebbing and flowing into different scenes and through different scenes, and able to do that in a supportive community. I'm not certain it's like that everywhere. And I could be just extremely lucky, but that's been my experience here.
Yeah. Well, I think having that variety is so important, you know,
And yeah, I like what you said about the grit, because I mean, even when I think about like some of the bands, the pop bands that have come out of Ohio, I mean, particularly like, you know, the funk and stuff like that, you know, the stuff came out of Cleveland, Cincinnati, Dayton.
Dayton, yep. Mm-hmm. That,
you know, hey, Bootsy Collins, come on, you can't go wrong with folk like that. But yeah, I like what you said about that, the grittiness, and it's like that Midwest, which I never understood why we call it Midwest. Yeah, we're just stayed away from the ocean.
Right.
But that kind of nose to the grindstone, hardworking, you know, just kind of grind it out sort of thing, that there's something about that comes through in the music. And that's always kind of appealed to me. I mean, certainly I love the polish of LA, but I like a little grit. I like a little grease in what I'm doing, you know? So
it's like the Stax versus Motown thing. Like the Stax was the more grit, more heart, and Motown, everything was super polished. And they were both hits. It's still great. It's all good, but definitely kind of a different feel. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, for my music, and you know, maybe it's just my excuse for just being sloppy when I play. I just like to hear the rawness and the realness of things, because to me, music is it is an expression. It's an emotional expression, and you know, that grit to me is the real. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like for you growing up, I mean, what were some of the influences that got you going in the direction that you're currently on?
Well, my household, I'm sure, had a lot to do with that. And me growing up as a member of the Salvation Army, so my childhood was filled with like Salvation Army brass band music. Like those were my first brass sounds that I heard, was that of the cornet. And like Salvation Army brass band playing is super silky and like glorious brass band sounds. And then, you know, also coming from my family is Black, and listening to Black music at cookouts and parties in the basements, you know, so there was Sly and the Family Stone, there was Anita Baker, there was, I don't know, all the Black music that my parents listened to, that they made us listen to, or, you know, that my aunties and uncles listened to. So that was kind of a cool mix for me of music growing up. You know, those sounds and that type of music was in my ear and in my heart growing up.
Yeah. Well, and how has that impacted, you know, the stuff you're doing right now? I mean, how are you pulling those influences together?
Yeah, it's kind of come full circle for me because I was 100% on the classical music path after high school and such. And I moved back to Cleveland. I was still doing the classical music thing for a majority of it until I just started taking any gig, really. And that opened my world up to everything and salsa, and still doing orchestral playing. And it led me to a band that I play in with now called Mourning a Black Star. And in this band, it feels like we do it all. It's really great mix of it's all original music, but our influence come from all the music that the eight of us collectively listen to. So me, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and Freddie Hubbard and Clifford Brown, but also classical stuff. We have one of our vocalists is like, she likes to sing rock music and was one of like the first Black women rock vocalists here in Cleveland when she moved back from LA back to Cleveland. So you've got my background merged with her background. And then we have someone who's into electronic music. He largely does our beats. So like we have this whole hodgepodge of musicians, and all of our backgrounds, mine included, of course, just comes out in the music that we create. So it really has come like full circle for me, just listening to all these different types of music, to me now being able to create and like everything, even if we don't think things influence us, like literally everything that we have heard or experiences influences us. So it comes out in all these different ways. And for us, when this band is called Mourning a Black Star, what we're creating is literally like all of our backgrounds and all of who we are coming together to create like magic. So it's really quite cool. So I see that kind of each time we perform and each time we create.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that like when we talk about music as being a method of communication, all that we are, all that we experience influences who we are. And then when we're being true, when we're being real about ourselves, that comes out in our communication. So as a musician, all of these different influences, I think that's where we create the really cool stuff.
Yeah.
We go back to like the origins of jazz, how jazz came about and what were the influences that created the music that we now call jazz, and then how that has evolved. And you go from Dixieland and swing to bop to cool jazz to fusion, so all these different influences begin to creep in.
Yep.
And then you evolve the art form. And to me, it's kind of an interesting conversation to have, particularly with people who are well versed in the classical world. Also within the commercial world and the jazz world. Some people have a hard time justifying or juxtapositioning those things. They see them as being so separate that you have to have these kind of hard and fast lines. And then people that are looking at it from more of a global perspective and saying, well, they're all just kind of different waves of speaking. How can I pull from this and make what I do that much better? So like, what are the biggest lessons that's like you learned from your orchestral playing, and then how has that impacted your jazz chops, for example?
I think the biggest thing that I learned in my classical playing and training was like the amount of listening that I did as a student. And this is like, listening to orchestral pieces, to when you're actually in the setting, to listening to everything that's going on around you. And that's literally something that you have to do in every setting, no matter what type of music you're playing, and kind of even more so when we don't have music in front of us. Like using my ears was something, and listening to the room and everyone around me, I think was one of the most important things that I had to learn. Also, that was a big thing in the Salvation Army brass band playing, because we are taught, like the cornet section, even if there are eight first row trumpets, then we need to sound like one cornet. It's not, so blending is a huge part of that, and listening to the section and then listening outward to the rest of the ensemble. That's something I use in all the groups that I play with now. I think that's really important.
Yeah. So, that is one aspect. So then, how about like the influences of Sly and Prince all the R&B, the soul, the pop music. How has that impacted you?
The groove has to be there. No matter what genre of music, there is definitely a groove. And if you ain't got it, then you can hear it, no matter what style of music you're playing. And that, I still think that goes back to using our ears more and listening to everything around us. But, also just realizing and hearing the different groove that's in the different types of music.
Yeah. Cool. Well, going back, I think this is going to be end up being the main theme of our conversation today is about the communication and of music. And, I was thinking about this morning, that you know, music is very interesting in that it is an art form. Mm-hmm. And it's also a form of entertainment. Mm-hmm. But it also has the ability to be an agent for social change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we go back and look at the role that music has played throughout history, but particularly as it has affected us here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So for you know, the global listening audience, you know, this is definitely part, you know, part of the American culture. But mm-hmm. How, you know, as we looked at the, particularly in the Black community, mm-hmm. How music has, you know, from the days of slavery has been such a huge part of our culture. And, you know, it's been something that's helped us get through the hardships. Mm-hmm. It was a huge part of the civil rights movement. Yeah. And then, you know, even, you know, for non-Black music, for like folk music and rock music, it's part of the cultural shifts, you know, that occurred like during Woodstock. All these different cultural shifts tend to have a music that is associated with it. So, you know, everybody comes into music from a different perspective and with a different focus. And not everybody is interested in making a statement with their music. Yeah. Is that something that's important to you? And if it is, what's a statement you're trying to make?
I think that now it definitely is important to me and is something I do intentionally in some of my projects and in some of my music. Like you said, like a lot of music that became popular was at first just protest music. It was like, you know, us human beings speaking about the shittiness of the human experience, and that because it's so relatable became popular. A lot of great music is protest music, and goes hand in hand with a lot of the movements that are present and that have come and kind of gone. I'm in my late 30s, and I just looking back on how and why I used to make music when I was younger is totally, well, not totally different, but it is different now that I've had a little bit more of a chance to live and experience sometimes like the harsh realities of being a Black woman here in the United States. So I say that to say, because of my human experience, it's absolutely a part of my music making. And also when I am not intentionally making music, like with Morning at Black Star, we are often asked if we are a political band, or we're automatically like given that title when we are just speaking about our lives, but people take that as automatically being political. So even if we're not trying to be political, sometimes, you know, people take our lyrics to the songs and make it a political statement. And that's like, oh, that's also an aspect of being Black in America. So everything we're experiencing as Black humans here comes out into our art. Oftentimes. And I mean, right now I'm doing a project called Afrofuturism, Black Lives Will Exist in the Future. And that is like a kind of a mantra for me to know that my life is important and that I will continue to exist. And my brothers and sisters, musicians or otherwise, are also out here just trying to exist and live our lives. With less and less of the racial terribleness that still exists in the world. So I think that is really hard to be an artist and kind of what it means to be an artist and not have things like that affect our music and affect the things that we speak in and perform about.
Yeah. Well, I think that when you're being true to yourself, you know, whether it be in the process of composition or improvisation or things like that, when you're being true to yourself, like you said, your experiences have to come out in your music. Mm-hmm. And, there's a difference between when we think politics or politicizing things, it's usually like the polarization sort of thing. It's like towing a party line sort mm-hmm. of. Instead of saying, it's that expression of this is my reality. These are my experiences. This is the way that, I've experienced life. This is the way I see life. And just letting that come through, whether it's the joy of it or it's the sorrow of it. So I kind of feel like the music that is going to be the most lasting is going to be that music that touches those chords. I mean, it's got to be, more than just, and I love party music, mm-hmm. I really love party music, but, while I love, I love Earth, Wind, and Fire, mm-hmm. of course, if you're a trumpet player, you got to love Earth, Wind, and Fire, right?
Exactly.
It's like, tunes like September and Let's Groove, we all know those and mm-hmm. like that, but of the songs, their songs, I certainly love them, I play them all the time, but the ones that speak to me the most are the ones that kind of have a deeper message than just the feel good danceable stuff, the stuff that's like those deeper statements about like that's the way of the world. That's one of my favorite tunes of all times, not just because of it's a great song. I mean, the lyrics are great, the mm-hmm. The harmonies and the melody and the arrangements and everything is just so great. Mm-hmm. But it's that idea, what it represents. That is what gets into my heart and stays in my heart more than just what gets into my ass.
Right.
But for you, you've got your involvement with Mourning a Black Star, and there's also, you've got the kind of the, I hate to say this, kind of like the double whammy, So you are a minority woman, mm-hmm. and that's like, okay, two strikes. Which is very unfortunate. And so for you, as you're experiencing life as a young Black woman trumpet mm-hmm. player, mm-hmm. that's three and a half strikes, I guess. What are some of the things that you see, like in terms of the industry and the social stigmas, whether they be positive or negative, that come along with your position?
Yeah, I think largely, and I have to say now, I experience negative things a lot less now. Which I am super thankful for. It still happens, of course, but me personally, I feel like I don't experience kind of outrageous things as much as they used to, 5-10 years ago for me. But it is still very much seen as a novelty to be a woman trumpet player, which, I just feel like at this point, that's such an old and tired thing. And so whenever I feel like that, I'm like, really? Like, you've never seen any women trumpet players? But also, it still happens where a lot of people don't experience that. I've been in situations where they don't believe I am the trumpet player, I am the vocalist or the flautist. I've been asked with horn in my hand, oh, you actually know how to use that thing? So it can be very just tiresome. But my mom is a retired Cleveland police officer, and I'm 4'11", so that might be another strike. My mom is like 5'2" on a good day. So as a child, I saw my mom navigate her world as a Black woman police officer in Cleveland, which is rough. It was rough, but I know for sure that impacted the way I am now as a Black woman trumpet player and freelancer out here, and just as a Black woman in general. I also had, you know, I have great parents. My father, growing up, he's a trumpet player as well. He always told me that, you know, people are going to think that you can't play. And I was kind of already ready as I could be for those situations because of my father telling me these things when I was quite young. Like, I started playing trumpet when I was 9. We probably started having these conversations when I was 11, 12. So when I did experience these things, I was kind of braced for them, kind of. Also, and seeing my mom have to navigate herself on the field as a police woman, with, you know, community and with other police officers, was like a really great lessons for me that I didn't even realize it until I was like out of college and experiencing the world. But yeah, it still happens. The novelty thing, and then also just people not expecting you to play as well or to have such a big sound. So yeah, but at this point it's just old. Like, I don't know what else to say about that.
It's like, yeah, really, you know, 2022 and we're still having this conversation. I hate it, because every time I have a female trumpet player on the hang, mm-hmm. I kind of always ask a question related to that. And I hate to have to ask a question, but it's still a question I think that needs to be brought up, and it needs to be recorded, because there's still too many people out there that have these judgments. It's like, well, and especially like in the world of commercial music, you know, and I have a good friend, and she's been on the show. Actually, she's the composer and the performer of our theme song, Lexi Signor. Lexi is a fantastic trumpet player, particularly as a lead trumpet player. She is a very, very great player. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she has told me, and friends that have been on gigs with her, and people will say stuff like the stupidest comment, which is usually like, wow, you know, you play really well for a woman. You know, you play lead trumpet and you're a girl. Wow. Yeah. And then you look at people like Lisa Whitaker and Lori Frank, you know, these just like completely crushed lead books. Mm-hmm. And you know, people are like, you can't do that. You're a girl. Why the hell not?
Yeah. So, and it's definitely a subject that it still needs to be talked about. And I have a student who is in high school and going through similar things. And we were talking, and in my head, I'm like, really? Even, you know, I have such hope for younger generations, but it's still prevalent here. And it starts when you're young. Like, these types of cultural norms happen when we're young. And again, it's still happening and still breeding in places, because I have to talk to my students about this. And as young as my high school female and women students. So yeah, it's definitely still something that persists, unfortunately, in our community.
Yeah. Well, you know, just kind of keeping on this topic for a couple more minutes, you know, whether it be women's rights, you know, racial rights, gender rights, you know, whatever it is, there's the identification. You have to first identify that there is a problem. You have to admit that there is a problem. Mm-hmm. You have to identify what is the problem, what is the cause of the problem. And then you have to find viable solutions. And I think with every solution, there you have to take a two-pronged approach. One approach is, what do you need to do, like the outside people? And then what do I need to do, the individualistic responsibility that comes along with that. So, you know, if we're talking about the Trump community, you know, and sometimes this is like the reverse stereotype, you know, if you are a Black trumpet player, mm-hmm. you are expected to be, you know, you're still, you know, people, if you go out there and blow some killer bebop as a black male musician, they'd be like, yeah, okay, well, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But maybe if I was playing classical, it would be a different thing. Like, wow, you know, he's a principal trumpet player.
Yeah.
So in the commercial world, you know, all right, well, as a person of color, being able to play culturally appropriate music is mm-hmm. a given. But as a female, sometimes it is not. So mm-hmm. you know, what are the things that we, like the trumpet community, what are some of the things that we can do to better tear down those walls, to make it easier for this next generation of young female trumpet players to feel like this is a safe environment for them? And then, you know, what is it that you in particular are doing to make that difference?
That's a really good question. I'm not gonna say I think I have all the answers. But I think what is most important is that, like, you know, most of us musicians, we have friends that are also musicians. If you have a good friend and colleague that you see just not doing the right things, you have to talk to them. There are things that some people will receive information differently, you know? So if I'm on a gig and something like racist happens or something happens because I'm a woman on stage or in the band, I have options, right? I could either say something in that moment to address the situation, or I could not say something in that moment and continue on with my gig and performance. So I'm in the best headspace to play as best as I can. And when I have situations, those are my two options. And oftentimes I will choose to forge ahead because it is more important that I play really fucking well than it is to address that situation in the moment. But if you have a friend that is seeing things happen in the moment and they know that it's not a good way to behave, then it is up to the people in your circle and your friends to call you out. I know, you know, as me being who I am, I am not, nor should I have to always take that burden of having to correct people, because, you know, I'm on the job just like you are and trying to play the best of my ability. So I think the most important thing is for, you know, if you have good friends and colleagues and you see that they're not, their actions are not aligning with what we as a music community need to make our community better, then you need to pull your friend aside and have that conversation with them. And it's a hard conversation to have, but that's what needs to happen. I think secondly is that everyone just needs to make greater efforts to hire women. I literally made a post, a Facebook post, maybe about a month ago, about how people should hire more women because we're out here. And the very next day, someone called me for a gig. And I took it. I was like, yay, yes, maybe they saw that post. I don't know. But in my mind, that was the scenario. I don't know if that's actually what happened. But that's, you know, a second great thing, like hire people, take a chance on people that you don't know. And that's another thing, like we get so comfortable working with and hiring the same people, I understand. But you gotta take chances on other people sometimes. That's another thing too. Sometimes people get really great positions and then they stay there like forever. But I think, you know, spreading the love around and giving other people some chances is a really great thing. It's like the scarcity effect, or like people being afraid to not have enough work, but there's work for all of us. So I think those things outwardly, like everyone could do and do their part and do our part, do my part. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I think as a teacher and an educator, a lot of what I try to do to make our community better is with my teaching and just existing. It's kind of like a lazy excuse, but kind of just existing is important. It's important for other young women to see me out here doing what I'd like to do and playing well, and kind of making a path and following in the path that's already been started with other women that have come before me and just continuing that path. I'm a founding member of the Chromatic Brass Collective. We are an organization for women and non-binary brass players of color. And we are a community for ourselves. So, you know, we have that community and village of people who understand what we go through as minority brass players. And so that's important to have too. So being a part of that is another way that me personally try to make our community a better and just safer space to thrive. Because you can't really create at 100% if you don't feel safe in the environment, you know, so that's like another added and needed level of what we need to exist and create freely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's definitely, it's like that conversation. I just, like I said, I just hate having it because you would think by now we'd be past a lot of this stuff. And yeah, you know, sometimes I have to put myself in check because I'll find myself thinking those thoughts of like, oh, that was pretty good for a, like, you know, but you know, it's just being, you know, you, like I said, you first have to be aware that there is a problem and mm-hmm. then you know, start taking the steps towards it. And it sounds like you've got some really great things going on. Mm-hmm. But like you said, you know, being the example is so important. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you were talking about your parents, you know, you have a mother who is a diminutive female and in a police force in Cleveland is not, you know, being a police officer in Cleveland is not like, you know, being a police officer in the, you know, Iowa City or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's got its grittiness to it. And a father who's a trumpet player. So, you know, obviously then you had two very strong influences on you in what has led you to be the person you are today. So obviously, you know, your mom is giving you some toughness, you know, that grit. And, you know, for your, was your dad like one of your teachers as you were growing up, you know, and what are some of the big things that you took away from him as a trumpet player?
Yeah, my dad was my first teacher. I had lessons kind of throughout my childhood, but I didn't really take it seriously until college. But my father would we'd play duets together all the time. So I think it wasn't maybe lessons per se, but we played a lot together. He would pull out these duet books that were like way above what I could actually do and make me play them. And I would get so frustrated. But obviously, I think it was good for me to try to play all these hard duets. And now I can like turn back on my father because he doesn't play as much anymore. So I now make him play hard duets with me. Payback. But yeah, I think kind of the simplicity of just playing duets and seeing music that, excuse me, looked really challenging in front of me. But I like that, I think helped me in other situations where you're just thrown some music that you're like, what is this? And then you just do it. So that made me more comfortable in situations like that, and just being able to go for it and do it and see what happens. I think the maybe biggest thing I learned from my father as a trumpet player is like the work ethic involved and like knowing what to do not, I hate to say to become successful, because like, what is that even? But at least to have a career as a freelance musician. Like I knew that I had to work hard. I knew that I had to practice. These were kind of the non-negotiables. And even I didn't really apply that again into college, but I knew that these were the things that I had to do if I wanted to make a career out of trumpet playing and freelancing. And then like the basic sound came largely from my father, and then the Salvation Army training and brass band playing. Like my father was a bandmaster in the Salvation Army, so he was the band leader in church, and for the division he led the youth band. So kind of just seeing that leadership is kind of what I see in myself as a adult trumpet playing freelancer, teacher, educator. People often say we have the same mannerisms as well.
That could either be a good thing or a bad thing. So
yeah.
we'll say it's good. It's all good.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Is your dad still alive?
Yeah.
Does he still plays?
Not so much. He has he's retiring again. He's retired from his official job. He used to work for the county, but he has a big band called Gabriel's Horns, and that's been in existence since about 1999 or so. And he's giving one last concert next month in November, so he can finally retire. So he's not playing so much unless I force him to play duets with me, which we'll do a couple times a year. but he conducts the band Gabriel's Horns, and I'm hoping he plays more when he retires.
Oh, that's good. So how does he feel about you being a professional musician?
He's really proud of me. he's mentioned like seeing my path and seeing me grow from, the more shy person and trumpet player to how I am now, and how kind of cool it is to see that growth happen, you know, because that's what can happen and generally happens as you get older. So I know he's proud of that. He's proud that I've carried on like the musician side. My brother's in the Air Force, or freshly retired from the Air Force. So we kind of say that my brother followed in my mom's footsteps, and I followed more and after my father's with the musical path. So it's cool to see that.
Yeah, that is. Well, yeah, we all have to find our own path. And yeah, I think a huge part of what we're saying, you know, as we mentioned earlier, about being the example, and you know, having someone in your house who could help to introduce you to the concepts, sound, you know, playing the duets, you know, understanding the importance of practicing and things like that. That definitely gave you a leg up. Now there are a lot of people that had, you know, all those opportunities and more and squandered them because they didn't take advantage of them. So, you know, it's just nice. And I think particularly in terms of things like sound, because when music in general, but trumpet specifically, is part of your life, like when you're growing up, it just makes it that much easier to have those concepts. My dad was a musician in his earlier stages of his career, became a minister later in life. But he was, I always had music in the house. And from him, I picked up like arranging concepts and things like that, because he did a lot of that sort of stuff. I look at it as like, okay, well, all of these things that were going on when I wasn't paying attention consciously, they just got sucked in my subconscious. I remember the first time I sat down to write a chart. It's like, I really didn't know what I was doing, but I watched my dad do it so many times that it was just like, oh yeah. So having those influence, I think, is so great. But you know, there, I'm sure then, you know, that was your foundation, but who were some of the other people that kind of like helped you to develop into the player that you are in terms of like your sound concepts or your approach concepts? Yeah.
My other large influence of trumpet, and also just knowing what career and what kind of path I wanted to take goes to my undergraduate trumpet professor, Dr. Patrick Reynolds. He was really pivotal for me. When I basically went into music after high school because, well, I had been doing music, you know, trumpet and cornet my entire life at that point. And I tried to figure out a different field that I could get my degree in, because I was like, all right, I've been playing trumpet for a while now. What else can I do? So I went into the field of music therapy, and I was set on, like, you know, getting my degree and certification as a music therapist. And I was almost done with that. The very last moment, in like the three and a half years of my undergrad career, I switched from music therapy to trumpet performance. I really enjoyed playing trumpet. I found myself just practicing trumpet and enjoying it and wanting to get better. I had a really great relationship with my professor, Dr. Reynolds, and it was a great experience. But I also realized that I wasn't practicing the things that I needed to for music therapy, which was guitar and piano. So I struggled for a while just figuring out what I really, really wanted to do, mainly because, again, I was trying to figure out what else I could do besides cornet or trumpet when I went into college. But I came right back to it. So I know that because I enjoyed lessons and playing and like playing in smaller chamber ensembles, I really enjoyed that, is when I realized that, okay, I think I want to just try this out. So Dr. Reynolds was a huge part of me kind of finding my way to that and realizing that I really just wanted to play my horn, and knowing that I could do this, you know, if I did all the things that I needed to. I remember working a lot on sound and kind of refining my sound. So while I had a great foundation, I knew what I wanted to sound like when I was quite young. I knew what a good sound was to me. I was able to refine that with Dr. Reynolds and her lessons. I was at the University of Dayton. So I feel like that's where I really found out that I wanted to pursue trumpet as a career.
Yeah. So who were there like any key professionals, you know, like working big name artists that you kind of like, yeah, this is a person that I'd kind of like to get their vibe, you know, I've had a few over the course of my life that have really kind of sparked me and inspired me, but who are some of the ones that stick out to you as your heroes?
Yeah, I remember when I first discovered Alison Balsam and Ingrid Jensen, and I kind of discovered them around the same time. When I was in Dayton, Ohio, I would, there was like these CD, like old CD stores, and that's like not even a thing anymore, but I would go in and like rummage through the CDs that they had and the old VHSs, like, yikes. And DVDs as well. And I found Ingrid Jensen, I think it was like Higher Grounds, or I know that's like a Stevie Wonder tune. But anyway, one of her first albums that I saw, and I didn't know who it was at all, but I saw that there was a woman holding a trumpet. And so I got the CD, and then like my kind of mind was blown. Anytime I see that, when I was discovering just so many different trumpet players and listening a lot more, anytime I saw and discovered a new woman trumpet player, I was like, oh my God, I really can do this. And it's amazing. And they got their own CDs and this is great. And then my teacher, Dr. Reynolds, introduced me to Alison Balsam, and I borrowed a couple of his CDs that he had of her. And actually, it was before I went to grad school, at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. It's like the semester before I started attending that for grad school. Alison Balsam was there giving a masterclass, and I got to play for her, and it was so great. I was like, I wasn't a part of the school at the time, so I had to like wait. I was dead last. I was no longer warmed up, but I played, and it was such a great experience. So those two names stick out a lot to me right now. Not a trumpet player, but when I discovered Velvet Brown, I was like, you're a Black woman tuba player? Like, where have these people been my whole life? It was really cool to hear. She sounds amazing. I was working as a trumpet teacher for a school in Akron, Ohio. And it was an art school. And the Stiletto Brass had came, and they are fantastic. I mean, it's all women playing brass instruments. And then there, I noticed a Black woman playing the tuba. And that's how I discovered Velvet Brown. So yeah, those three names are probably the most influential to me right now, and have been in my career.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the importance of being that example, because you never know that there's always someone that can identify with you, that if you're out there and you're making your statement and doing your thing, then that's you never know who you're going to impact. Mm-hmm. And it's the one thing that I've been noticing in our conversation there is a definite passion for what you do and a love for what you do, and it comes through in everything that you say. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a key thing for someone who, in addition to their performance, because that needs to come out in your music, the authenticity, but also as an educator, because I know you are an educator as well. Mm-hmm. So when you get into the education side of things, what are the main things that you're trying to get across to your students, other than this is how you finger a high F sharp?
Mm-hmm. fun. Like, it has to be fun. Now, practicing is not always going to be fun, but when we are making music, if you're not feeling joy and having fun, then something is wrong. Something is wrong. So I think that's one of the most important things. I mean, what I try to remember when I am practicing is that I have to have fun still. Like, and when this stops becoming fun, then I need to reevaluate things. But if it is fun, then we will generally just want to keep practicing and getting better and trying things and, being playful. it's really, really, really important. I think I learned a lot from my students. I teach a wide range. I love my beginner students. They keep everything like new and fresh for me. And they are always really inquisitive, and they ask me questions. And I'm like, I don't know, but let's figure this out together. I never have all the answers. And I really love teaching because of that. Like, they bring, my students bring like the wonder in lessons often. And then that keeps me interested and intrigued as well. So it's kind of like a cycle, a circular thing, a give and take thing in lessons. But for my older students, it's keeping it fun. I feel like now too, a lot of high school and college age students got a lot going on. Their schedules are like jam packed with just stuff, and it's easy to have trumpet just to be another thing on the list that you have to do that week. And like it shouldn't feel like that. It's gonna feel like that sometimes, but it should be more joy than it feels like a task to check off.
Yeah, it's funny because I think. I believe in the power of words. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what we have to do is we have to consider the words that we use and the meanings that those words have to us. And sometimes it's a very subliminal kind of concept. It's a more visceral thing. And so like for most people, the word practice has a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. You know, so you take the words practice and play, and I've talked about this before on the podcast that, you know, my background is in a big part of my background is in martial arts. Mm-hmm. And in Chinese martial arts, they don't use the word practice, it's play. So the Chinese word lian is mm-hmm. to play. And so you wouldn't say, are you going to practice your kung fu today? It's like, you know, are you going to play kung fu today? It's just sometimes it's that little mind shift that occurs when you use the word, because mm-hmm. when it's like I gotta practice again, that's different than I get to play my horn again. So it's the fun part is I think very, very critical. Now of course there has to be the balance doing just playing tends to be, you know, if we're just given the option of playing, we're going to do what we're good at and mm-hmm. enjoy, as opposed to when we practice, we're trying to make improvement, we have to do the stuff that we suck at. That's why I love that there's a phrase that I've used a lot, is embrace the suck.
Yes, it's real.
And when you learn to do that, when you learn to be comfortable being uncomfortable, then that's when you start to make progress. I look at, if there's something that I can't do, then that's exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, if I can do it, then it becomes boring. There's no joy in being able to do it. It's pulling off that lick that, you know, 6 weeks ago you couldn't play. When you suddenly nail it, you're like, oh yeah, the practice is paying off.
Yes.
So, you know, as an educator and as a mentor, because I definitely got that vibe from you that you're more of the mentor educator than just the you know, here, play Clark 3.
Yes.
So what are some of the tools that you use to help people to learn how to embrace the suck?
I don't know if I would like say it's a tool, but I have had some like personal experiences where I have felt comfortable enough in my lessons to just play. And I've had some lessons, like personal lessons, where I was just so scared to mess up. And I always try to make my lesson environments for my students a place first where they just know that they can just come and play. Like, I don't care if you miss a note. Like, we can fix notes. It's fine. I don't care. But I need the students to come in and just be comfortable playing, because if they're not comfortable in the space with me playing, then we can't really learn. We're not going to be able to have a very great lesson. So I just want the space that I kind of cultivate for my students to be like a safe, fun, creative space. We can both mess up and it's fine. Like, no one's listening to judge, but we're just listening to work on the things that you want to. And I think it's important just to let the students kind of lead the lesson. And I always check in with my students and see what they want to work on. And for my younger students, is asking like, what type of music do you want to learn on trumpet? because that's what's important. You know, I don't want to just feed you a bunch of stuff that I have. I can do that all day, but it'll be more fun for me and you if you let me know like what you're into right now. If you want to learn some game and music, we can do that. Cause there's, you know, you can learn technique and all the technical stuff and skills and any type of music. But if the students aren't like engaged and into what you're teaching them or trying to show them, it's never going to stick and it's not as well received. So I think for me, just cultivating that space, that safe and fun, comfortable space is the most important. And I think we learn better that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I was having a conversation recently with a friend of mine who's a bass player, bass and guitar. Mm-hmm. And he messaged me to say, "Hey man, I just taught my first trumpet lesson today." I'm like, "What?" What? And he went on to explain it was like, it was about improvisation and, yeah. And, mm-hmm. and melodic concepts. And mm-hmm. he had said something like, "Well, yeah," I told him, "yeah, he needs to go listen to some Louis Armstrong," which I was like, I don't know if I would do that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, because he's kind of at a stage in his playing, he's, you know, he's an older guy, he's been playing for a long time. He's like, "Yeah, you got to go back to the roots." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, eventually, but honestly, I think, you know, depending on what kind of music, you know, if they're more into like pop or you know, yeah. things like that, you know, maybe you should have told him to go listen to Roy Hargrove's work on D'Angelo's Voodoo."
Yeah.
That would be much more approachable. It would be much more directly applicable. Mm-hmm. It's still damn good, you know? Yeah. You know, because you got to get them in and you got to make it something that they can see the usefulness of, because yeah. you go back and listen to pops. You know, it took me a long time to get to the point where I could go back and actually, even though he was still alive when I was, you know, first starting to play trumpet, mm-hmm. I didn't appreciate what he was doing, you know, and now that I've been able to go back and listen to him and, yeah. and Roy Eldridge and Sweets Edison and people yeah. like that, yeah, I can see how stuff has progressed and how it has evolved into what we call modern trumpet playing.
Yeah.
But at that point, I just, you know, I wasn't ready for it, you mm-hmm. know. I needed something that spoke to me and my immediate kind of needs and concerns. Yeah. So, you know, I like that approach of just like, you know, let's find out what's going to get them excited.
Yeah. And I've discovered so much from my students. There's so much good music. I mean, there's a lot of bad music, but there's so much good music out here. And a lot of I've learned a lot from my students. So, yeah.
That's good. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to me, like, you know, you're born in Cleveland. You go away to school and now you're back in Cleveland.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, you know, especially if they're trying to build a career as a freelancer or things like that, they want to, you know, "I want to be in New York, I want to be in Nashville, I want to be in LA." But you're back home. So, I mean, was that, how did you come about to that conclusion? Mm. And how do you see yourself as being, like a part of the Cleveland music scene, and not just the performance, but how do you see yourself as being an impact to the music that's coming out of Cleveland now? Mm.
So out of grad school, I was working at Office Max, and I could either at the time stayed in Cincinnati, Ohio, and tried to build my career up in that area. I didn't really know too many people there. I knew a couple people, but I would have definitely had to build my way up and still working at Office Max, which is not glamorous. Or I had an opportunity to take an interview at Cuyahoga Community College. They were looking for another trumpet professor. I was classically trained, fresh out of grad school, and they were looking for someone more on the classical side, which was me. I didn't do any jazz in college. I didn't do any jazz until after college, except with my father's band. But it was kind of like the perfect opportunity for me to take a job Even though they didn't really have any students for me at the time, I think there was maybe one student that wanted non-jazz lessons. So I could either move back to Cleveland and take that job at Tri-C, or stay in Cincinnati and continue working at Office Max with no students. So that is what brought me back to Cleveland. I moved back to Cleveland in 2009. And I think for the first 10 years, maybe even 7 years, I could have went anywhere the opportunity took me. But now I've worked really hard to build my career here, and I'm definitely at a point where I don't think I would move unless something like crazy amazing happened and took me to a different part of the States or out of the States. But I've got a great handle of my career here, and I'm able to perform. I'm able to collaborate. And I don't have to eat rice every day. Like, I remember I have a friend who moved to New York. I mean, I have several friends that moved to New York, but this one in particular years ago, and they were telling me how great New York was, but they were like broke and, you know, trying to make it in the city and had to eat rice for a month. And I was like, well, I mean, I don't want to eat, I like meat. Like, I want to eat a steak and still travel. Like, that does not sound appealing to me. So, like, New York, obviously, and LA and all Nashville, great cities with great, you know, music communities. But I felt like I was here in Cleveland, the rent is cheap, and I can still play my trumpet and I can still teach. So that is largely what has kept me here. Yeah, because I like to eat meat. I was just like, how does that, doesn't make.
Well, you know, you had alluded to this earlier. You're talking about, you know, success and, you know, what is success? And this is a topic that I love to talk about and think about, because, you know, success is an individual thing. And I think you have to have a very clear definition of success. And for years, I struggled with this thing about like being able to call myself a professional trumpet player. Mm-hmm. Because to me, you know, I couldn't be a professional trumpet player unless I was a, you know, Wayne Bergeron or Alan Vizzuti or Michael Sachs or, you know, those are professional trumpet players. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then I had to, and then, you know, what is a successful career? You know, if I'm not playing on Broadway, or if I'm not playing at the Met, or if I'm not doing, you know, soundstage work, then I'm not, you know, I'm not successful. Mm-hmm. And it's coming to that realization is like, okay, well, if you're getting paid to play, you're a professional.
Yeah.
And that's it. And, you know, then if my definition of success is that I want to be able to, you know, I want to be able to make enough money playing trumpet to just be able to play trumpet, which isn't what I do because I like to do too many things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you have to be touring with a major orchestra or, you know, selling out stadiums with a, you know, a major act, you know, to be a working professional and to have a successful career. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to be teaching at Juilliard to be a successful educator.
Yeah.
So, you know, being able to come to having a clarity of what it is that's most important to you, what are the aspects? Because certainly, like you said, yeah, you can move to New York, but you know, but that wouldn't be a good fulfilling life for you because right. You're going to get your stakes.
Yeah.
So you get to do all the stuff that you want to do, you know, without having to sacrifice so much. So yeah. When you're, you know, again, with the mentoring sort of thing, do you see this as being a issue with a lot of students of like having these, for lack of a better word, unrealistic expectations of what a career in music can and should be?
Yeah, I mean, and I I mean, I should say also that it's something that I struggle with at a point as well. And it'll come and go in certain points of my career now, even, you know, because, you know, that's another part of the human experience sometimes, that self-doubt and just not thinking that you're on the right path is just something that sometimes happens in our thoughts. But yes, I whenever I've given talks about my career and also just talks with my students about what a music career can be and can look like, is I just try to make sure that this everyone knows, and everyone I talk to that is asking about possible careers, that you can quite literally do whatever you want. You just have to know what you want to do. And also just making sure that my students know that it's like not one way. You can do however many things you want to. There was a point in time where I didn't think that like you can call yourself a musician if you also had a 9-to-5 job. Obviously that is not true. Like these people and my colleagues who have 9-to-5 jobs and also play, they're musicians. Like that was something that I had to get out of my head, because that's a terrible way to think. And it's just not true. you know, you can do whatever you want. And yeah, it's a really important thing to know, because especially with social media now, and just you're able to see what the lives that people put on social media, and it can kind of messes up mentally. And then we start seeing what everyone else is doing. That happened to me actually just kind of more recently than not. I had a lip injury. I fell on my face and busted my lip and I couldn't play. It was terrible. My teeth went through my bottom lip. It was a bad time. This happened in June, like right after I got back from the International Women's Brass Conference and the International Trumpet Guild Conference. I was in really, really great trumpet shape and ready to start my summer. And then that happened. And then I would see my friends that were touring and just performing and getting all these great gigs. And I'm like, oh no, what am I doing? I'm not even a musician anymore. I can't even play. I'm not on any amazing tours. I'm stuck at home. I didn't leave my house. So that's definitely something that can just come and go based on where we are in our lives. But it's important to know that these specific things does not take away from who you are as a musician. And if, you know, if we're creatives, then we are creatives. And if we are musicians, then we're musicians. And we shouldn't base our path and our desires off of what other people are doing. I'm glad I know that now. It's making my life much happier.
Yeah, well, it's one of those hard lessons. And like you said, you know, it does come and go, you know, and it's something that I think we all struggle with, and we will always struggle with, but that's part of the growth process, you know? Uh-huh.
Yep.
So again, embrace the suck, embrace the struggle.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got a couple segments that we go through in every episode, and I want to get to those before we run out of time. And the first one is brought to us by my good friend Michael Barkley of Barkley Microphones, and it's called Sound Off, and it's about approaches to sound. And you talked a little bit earlier about you know, how your dad helped you with developing your concept of sound, and then your professor helped to kind of dial that in. So from your perspective now as an educator, you know, what's some of the advice that you give to people in terms of how to develop a trumpet sound that's the best sound for them and for what they are trying to accomplish?
Listen a lot to a lot of different trumpet players, but also just a lot of different types of music. I teach a world music course, and like showing and being able to experience all these different types of music, I think is really, really important for me, for the students in this world music class, and also for young musicians, just having an ear, listening to all the different sounds and all the different instruments, kind of around the world, then you can really know like what you want to sound like. I think that helps a lot, listening to as much as we can in all the instruments. I mean, you can't really listen to all the instruments, but as many sounds and instruments as you can, just to get all these sounds in your head. So like, you know, it's kind of limitless, and that will can give us an idea of what we want to sound like and what type of music you might want to make.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. I mean, I know for me, one of the things that like you talk about listening and listening to more than just trumpet, you know, the inspirations that you can get from listening to a great vocalist or a great violinist or things like that, you pick up things in terms of like the richness of their sound or their phrasing or things like that. And all those things go into making your unique sound. So
yeah. Yep, exactly.
That's good. That's good stuff. All right. Awesome. Our next segment is called Geared Up, and Geared Up is brought to us by Venture Mouthpieces, Venture, where technology, design, and craftsmanship intersect. Use the code TRUMPETGEARS21 to get 10% off your order. And this is about equipment. Yeah, you can't talk trumpet without talking gear. But again, in typical Trumpet Gurus fashion, we want to go a little bit beyond just, you know, the surface stuff, and particularly in, yeah, the idea of how gear, you know, gear being the interface between us and our audience. What's the role that you see gear playing? And then how do you approach, particularly again with your students, how do you approach those aspects and how you make, how that education helps to make the distinction to find the right gear for your job?
I think I am probably the worst gear person ever. Like, it's kind of bad. People ask me what I play on, and like sometimes literally have to look at my horn to remember what it is, because I'm just like, I don't know, it sounds good, I like it. The worst gear head ever. When it comes to equipment, again, with my students also, it's probably, you know, definitely a hole in my teaching. I don't focus a whole lot on it. Just like the very basics and making sure everyone is set up okay. I do, with my older students, like I'm happy for them to explore. And it's probably because I'm so not a gear person that I'm like, you should try other things, try other horns, try other mouthpieces, and do and play on whatever works for you. And it's like new territory for me, because I played on the same things for a really long time. I didn't get a new horn until I mean, not too long ago. So I was just used to playing on my setup and not really reaching to try anything else because it was fine. but I'm more adventurous now with gear. So yeah, that's probably not the greatest, but that's an area that I should improve on.
All right. Well, you're going to have to keep me posted on your explorations then. Yeah, because that is a rabbit hole.
So. Yeah, I mean, I've like very minimally gone down like different mouthpieces. And I mean, I bought a BAC and I love the sound, but it was also like, I just realized too, I'm always realizing these things, that I can sound the way that I want. So I don't have to play on a Bach. I don't have to play on a whatever. And I really enjoyed the sound of the BAC. So I bought it. So I guess I have started my exploratory period.
All right. Well, awesome. All right. We have one final segment to get through, and this is brought to us by Robinson's Remedy, rapid relief for your sore and tired chops. This is the Robinson's Remedy rapid fire round. It is a series of questions that kind of bounce all over the place. And I just need your quickest response. So right. Teresa, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's fire it off. Here you go. First question. Who's the biggest influence in your life that is not a trumpet player?
My mother.
Okay. I thought she was the smallest influence in your life. What is your favorite book?
Love is Letting Go of Fear. I think that's what it's called.
What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
The Black Swan was pretty terrible. I went to see that with my father. We both did not like it.
Yeah, I have not seen that. So I've heard mixed reviews. So, if you weren't a trumpet player, what would you want to be?
Ooh, I would be like a second grade teacher.
Okay. What is your favorite drink?
My favorite drink is beer. I like IPAs.
Okay. IPAs are good. You can have a dinner party and invite any three living people. We'll exclude your family. Okay. Three people in the world, whether you knew them or not. Who would you want to have there?
Ezra and Spalding, Queen Latifah, and Oprah.
Ooh. There's some power there. All right. You've got three additional chairs. Any three people from history?
Ooh. That's a good question. My brain is not good with quick firing. I'm going to say Betty Davis. I'm going to say Tina Turner and Michael Jackson.
Okay. Lacquer, plated, or raw?
Raw.
All right. What is your favorite quote?
We're all in this together by ourselves.
All right. What's your greatest fear?
My greatest fear is failure.
You're not alone in that, I'm afraid. You could be granted one superpower. What would it be?
Ooh, that is a great one. I think flying would be very cool.
Okay. What aspect of trumpet playing do you find to be the most overrated?
Playing high.
High notes.
Yes.
kids. What aspect of trumpet playing do you find to be the most underrated?
Simplicity, like simple lines, melodic playing.
Okay. You could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice about music. What would it be?
Be fearless and keep going.
And you're going to give your younger self advice about life.
Kind of the same, but I'll say, I guess part two of that, the keep going part, super duper important.
Okay, cool. All right. And a final question for you, Teresa, what do you want your legacy to be?
I want people, when I'm no longer here and my name is mentioned in the room, to say that I have left a positive impact on the music community.
All right. Well, that is wonderful. And that's that, I think, you know, of all the things that we can do, that as a musician, that's it. We just want to make a positive impact. Mm-hmm. So, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. This has been great. You're enjoyable.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, I hope that one day I can get out to Cleveburg and hang with you at some point. And we'll go down to the flats and
we'll have IPAs on deck. I'll be ready.
Oh man. I can't drink IPAs anymore. So.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but I can't drink whiskey. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can meet there in the middle.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck in your ongoing adventures as a performer, as an educator, as a change agent. And I look forward to kind of following your career and seeing where things take you, because you got a lot going on.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for another great episode of Trumpet Guru's Hang. Make sure you like, subscribe, share. And yeah, if you've got a guest that you'd like to see on the show, hit me up. Topic you'd like me to cover, I'm always open to suggestions. And you know, make sure you check out what Teresa's got going on, and follow the links in the show notes to kind of keep up with her work and, you know, support her in any way you can, because, you know, I think she represents the future of trumpet, and, you know, we got to stick together, folks, because we're all in this together. What's the last part of that?
Fire ourselves.
All right. Well, thanks, y'all. And as always, peace of slide grease. We out.
Thanks for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating deeper connections through our mutual love of music and the trumpet life. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also like and share this episode with a friend. We want to see the hang grow for show. Please support our sponsors and consider becoming a personal supporter of this podcast as well. Remember, for less than the price of a bottle of valve oil a month, you can keep this podcast moving smoothly. The Trumpet Guru's Hang is recorded at the Candy Factory, a co-working space and social club located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jose Johnson is the executive producer. Post-production editing is by Mitch Bowers. Our opening theme song was composed and performed by Lexi Signor, and our closing theme music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. Incidental music is by Ethan Swayze and Jose Johnson. Graphic design by Ann Kirby of The Sweet Corps. The Trumpet Guru's Hang podcast is produced in collaboration with the So Good Lancaster Media Group.